always like this part of the year. Not just because of the leaves and the nice season, but I think I like sports. I like football. We kind of have a sports-minded town, don't we? We have, you know, people, the Red Sox, there's Red Sox fans, and there's Patriots fans, and there's Bruins fans, and there's even a rumor there's Colts fans in the vicinity, and Broncos fans, but we won't talk about that. It's a sports-minded town. Lots of people like sports. And, you know, that was not, it's not anything different in our day than it was in Bible times. There were, especially in the city of Corinth, which is where we're going to be studying this morning, it was a very sports-minded town. They had something called the Isthmus Games. And probably most of the young boys in Corinth would have aspired one day to participate in those games. Just like today, young boys kind of look at, wow, what if I could participate in some of the professional sports, you know. And Paul knew that. He recognized people that were sort of sports-minded. And he didn't mind borrowing from that to make some very practical observations about what the Christian's life ought to be like as he pulled some, drew some analogies to the sports in his day. And so we're going to look at this little section, 24 to 27. Let's read it one more time. And I have the New International Version, so that may read just a little bit different than the way yours does. But it says, "Do you not know that in a race, all the runners want run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I don't run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize." That's a New International Version, which is a little bit different. As you read through that, probably things were already jumping out at you. What you might see as some lessons. I'm just going to give you four to think about this morning. For us to think, there's all kind of illustrations to help a Christian relate to what his life ought to be like before the Lord and God. And the apostles will use illustrations like a soldier who's in an army. And there are great lessons from that. But in this case, he's like an athlete that's in a race. And the first thing that I observed when I was reading this is that not all people who contend are successful. He says only one. He says all race, all run in the race, but only one receives the prize. Now, this isn't the most positive lesson, but it's a realistic lesson, that there are winners and there are losers. You ever watch sports on TV, and after the game, inevitably, where will the cameras zoom in on? They zoom in on the losers, don't they? I don't know why they want to do that, but they'll zero in on these guys that are sitting there on the bench, and they're just wiped out. And they got their head between their legs, and they're some of them are just weeping, grown men. And they're crying because it is hard to lose in a big game. And Paul pulls from this idea of just one will win. Just to make the point, you know, that some will not win in the game of life. Some won't win. Look at Matthew chapter 7, 21 to 23. Here are some people that thought they were going to win, but they found out they didn't. Chapter 7, 21 to 23. Matthew 7, 21 to 23 says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?' And then I'll tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you who work iniquity.'" So here are some people who thought they were going to win, but they didn't. And then if you look over one other example, Matthew 25, when you have some people who've come to the end of the race, and they're all standing there and they're waiting for the trophies. They're waiting to see what they're going to get. And in verse 40, they stand before the king, And the illustration in this case is sheep and goats. And he says, I'll tell you the truth. Whatever you did for the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. And then verse 21, he will say to those on his left side, depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was stranger and you didn't invite me in. I needed clothes, you didn't clothe me. I was sick in prison, you didn't look after me. And they'll answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison or, and didn't help you? And he will reply, I'll tell you the truth. Whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And they'll go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So here's some people who were surprised. Look at me, a lot of people that really are surprised in the day of judgment. When they think they finished the race and they don't hear it, the answer that they wanted. And here's another picture. See if you can guess what's going on in this one. You've probably seen pictures like this before. It's usually somebody going, what? You know, they go, what are you talking about? Because somebody's just thrown a penalty flag. And they're in trouble. Because they didn't what? They didn't play by the rules. They broke the rules. They said, I didn't do that. What are you talking about? But how many times will people lose the race? I mean, we can relate to this. Paul relates. You know, this is just what we know. We know this happens all the time in games. People lose the race. They get kicked out of the game. They get penalized because they don't play by the rules. But of course, they never think you really. You always say, I didn't do that. What are you talking about? But they did. And Paul said in another place, if anyone who competes as an athlete, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. He doesn't mind borrowing from things in this life. Because we all understand that. But so many times we don't play by the rules. We want to play by our own rules. And what he says is not all people who contend will be successful. That's the first lesson that I just wanted to observe with you. As we think about running in the race, these races don't count. They really are worthless. They're meaningless. We may get excited and like to watch them, but ultimately in the end they don't count. But the race we're in, it really counts. And whether we finish it and get the prize or not means everything. And to not play by the rules and get disqualified is just foolish. To not play by the rules. Well, he says there's more. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 9 again. He says, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run, therefore, in such a way as to get the prize. You need, success requires great effort. That's what I took from this. Success requires great effort. You got to run in such a way to win. Now, some people say, well, we're not going to win. God's going to win it for us. God will win the race. We're not going to do the winning. God will win the race for us. And in a measure, I see the point of that. God is the one that's going to ultimately be the one that decides who will win the race and who won't. And I don't deserve it. I can't run fast enough or box well enough or pass well enough to deserve to win. I mean, God's grace is what's going to provide us with that championship. It will be a favor to us if we win, not because we deserve it. There's a lot of truth to that. But some people will take that many times to the extreme that they shouldn't, to say, well, there's just nothing at all that we have to do. We don't do anything to participate in this race in order to win. We have nothing to do with the victory if we win. And Paul would not agree with that, because he would say, you need to run like you want to win this game. Like you really want the prize. It requires great effort. When we lose a game, when somebody, you're watching a football game, you're watching a baseball game, they lose the game. You ever hear people say, they didn't want that very bad. They didn't want that very bad. Or they didn't come to play. They never showed up today. You just get really mad at your team because they came out there and they loafed around and they piddled around. And so many times that you can have a really good team, but they will play very poorly against a poor team because it doesn't require much effort. They won't put much effort into it. And they'll end up losing sometimes. The least likely team to beat them will be the ones to beat them because they don't come ready to play. And so we'll say, they weren't prepared. Or they were overconfident. They were too confident in themselves. And often, you know, and sometimes that's the way we run this race. Sometimes we're like that. We're kind of lazy. We don't put a lot of effort. We just put a little effort. Because we kind of assume that God's going to take care of it. He's going to save us regardless of how much energy and effort I put into it. But I don't think that we're encouraged. He says, run in such a way that you may attain it. Run in such a way that you may attain it. Here's the guy that we see. We see him stretched out. I couldn't find any good pictures. But sometimes they'll zero in on the guys, and you can see every muscle in their body just at its most intense, in this most intense form. And they will work as hard as they can to win that race. You can't be lazy and win those races and those competitions. You just can't do it. And Paul said, we want each of you to show the same diligence to the very end in order to make you your hope sure. We do not want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who through faith and patience inherited what has been promised. He said, show the same diligence to the very end. I think in that passage he used Abraham as his example. A man who worked throughout a good portion of his life in Canaan to attain an inheritance they really never even attained while he was alive. But he stayed with the program and he worked very hard. And a lot of people in the Bible you could bring into play. In fact, I think Hebrews chapter 12, we'll read that later on. He refers back to chapter 11 where he has a whole hall of fame of people who had worked diligently to receive that prize, who had put forth great effort to get there. And we shouldn't be any different. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. I think 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. Let's see, look at that. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. First Peter chapter 4. In verse 8, he says, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. That's the New International Version. You got another version, it'll say, love one another fervently. And the word that he uses there is an adjective, and the word means to stretch or to strain oneself. It's kind of interesting. Because that same word, when it's used in Romans 10 and verse 11, where it says "love the brethren," it's the verb form, and it means to boil. It means to boil or to heat up. Either case, the point is, with tremendous energy and with tremendous intensity, I'm going to have to put forth if I'm going to love people the way I ought to. I don't do that all the time. I'm pretty lazy sometimes. Sometimes when problems come with a relationship between me and somebody else, a lot of times it's because I didn't really put forth much effort. I gave it a shot. I took a little crack at it, but it's a mess because I didn't put much effort into it. And he says, for the Christian, you need to put forth intensity, boil, stretch yourself, strain yourself, like these athletes do in games that really don't count for anything ultimately. But we need to put energy into what we do to love one another. Extend ourselves beyond what maybe we think we're capable. And if we don't, Paul has a warning. He warned the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 1. The Corinthians were kind of lazy. They took God's grace for granted. We count on God's grace. We have to, because like I said, ultimately it's a favor to us that He's going to save us. Not because we deserve it, not because we've done it well enough to earn it. But if we presume upon His grace, we take it for granted, then it's going to be not applied to our case in the end. And he says here, as God's fellow workers, we urge you not to receive God's grace in vain. For he says, in the time of my favor, I heard you, and in the day of salvation, I helped you. I helped you. I heard your cries. I reached out and helped you. Don't make that a waste of my effort. Don't make my grace in vain, because you didn't do your part. Success requires great effort. And Paul recognizes that at the end of our passage in 1 Corinthians 9. What's the last thing he says? He says, I beat my body, I make it a slave, so that after I preach to them, I myself will not be, what? Disqualified from the prize. Even the Apostle Paul recognized that his apostleship did not guarantee that he's going to be saved. It was just a role that he was given. He had to work and do the work that God had given him to do, but that wasn't a trophy. That wasn't a guarantee he was going to be saved. He said, I can be disqualified. And so he had something to do in order to show his relationship to God was not to be taken for granted. And sometimes when I don't do my part, when I was a kid, I'd play a football game, and afterwards my dad would say, he'd say, you guys didn't play very well. You kind of loafed around up there today. And I'd give him all kinds of, they were really hard. The referees did a lousy job. They didn't call the game right. He'd say, I don't want to hear all that. He said, you were lazy. I watched you. Oh, that hurt. I never did want to admit it, but he knew he was right. And when we won, a lot of times, you know, we did well. Or sometimes we'd even lose the game, but he might say, you know, you guys did great. You did really well. Because I could tell you put your whole heart into it. You worked really hard. Yep, they were good. And you had some lousy calls by the referees and you lost. But you know what? You really tried. I saw you. And you didn't quit. And you know, there was the grace and the mercy. He understood. But what he wanted to see was people putting in my best effort forward. And then that's what he wanted to see. So that's what Paul was saying. It requires great effort so you don't get disqualified. And then the third one that I noticed is that success requires discipline. Here it is. Look down in verse 25. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. And that's the New International Version. Strict training. But the other version, I think, says discipline. Or shows self-control. Can you imagine if we played let's imagine for a minute we're going to play a game of baseball here today. And there's a team that we're going to play against. And they're called the Red Sox. Now we're pretty good. I mean, we have some pretty good baseball players here, and we have some talent. But how do you think we'd fare out if we played the Red Sox today? What chances do you think we'd have of winning? I'd say zero. We'd probably get the Sox beat off of us, unintended. They'd beat the daylights out of us because we just don't. They train every day. They play and they play and they train and they play, and their whole lives are devoted to that game, and that's what makes them good. Not because they were born with that talent, because they trained until they developed the kind of talent they need. We haven't got a chance against them. There's another thing that really amazed me. You ever seen the Ironman triathlon? You ever heard of that? That is unbelievable. It's a triathlon, so it's three parts. They do it in Hawaii. And you swim. You have to swim 2.4 miles. You have to run 26.2 miles, and you have to bike 112 miles. Whole course, 140 miles, 140.6 miles to run that course. How much training do you think is involved to get somebody ready to participate in that race? Well, there's the swimming, biking, running. Here it is. Here's what you have to do. You have to run 70 miles a week. 70 miles per week. You have to bike 400 miles per week, and you have to swim 18 miles per week. That takes a lot of time. You can't do that in one day. I mean, that's, I'm talking about 6 to 8 hours per day. Their whole week. These guys can't have real jobs. There's no way. I mean, they just can't. I mean, they devote their entire being and all of their time to be able to participate in order to compete in that particular event. You know what else they don't do? They don't eat a bunch of Twinkies either. You know? These guys have rigid diets. They eat right. And they don't stay out all night. And they don't smoke. And they don't drink. And they are disciplined people. Very self-disciplined people. And Paul is saying that Christians need to do the same kind of people. I mean, he says that we need to be part of a training of strict discipline, strict training, self-control. And if you look in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, he still again borrows from this idea of how much energy and effort people put into that when it comes to physical training. And he says, for physical training is of some value, but godliness has value for all things, holding promise for both the present life and the life to come. And in this other version, he says, train yourself to be godly, for physical training has some value, but godliness has value for all things, holding promise for both the present life and the life to come. You know why those athletes train with such rigidness and have such self-control and self-discipline? Because they want to win the prize, and they really value winning that race. How much do I value winning this race? Because if I value that, I ought to be able to apply the same kind of discipline and spiritual thing. You know, when I don't do well, and we don't do well spiritually in different things, love for one another or whatever the particular thing is we're falling down on, whatever our temptation is or whatever our failure is, we just need to have the courage to say, you know what, I don't value heaven very much. I really don't value the prize all that much. I'm not saying we can't fail sometime and get back up and repent and go at it again with all our heart, but I'm saying sometime when we fail, we just really don't value the prize as much as people in the world value temporal prizes. And that's really sad. You know, what's kind of interesting to me is that, and ironic, is that somebody who runs these races, if you're talking about that with somebody, a lot of times they'll say, man, those guys are great. I sure wish I was like them. Boy, I wish I had the self-control they had. You know, they don't stay out. They don't drink. They don't smoke. And they'll talk about it, all of that in very positive terms. But if you talk about a Christian and him applying that same those same exact principles, those same types of disciplines to himself, people, they'll mock you. They'll say, what's the matter with you? Christians, they can't have any fun. They don't do anything fun. They can't do anything. You know. But they'll praise the athlete who will exert and practice the same kind of things that we're trying to practice to be a Christian. I think that's kind of interesting. Look, if you would, in 1 Peter 4. Here's where you see that. 1 Peter chapter 4. He says in verse... why don't we just read this section here, starting in verse 2. No, let's read verse 4. They think it's strange, talking about the world, the Gentiles, the world, as they look at the Christians. They think it's strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood, or excess, if you have another translation, of dissipation. It's like self-indulgence, basically. And they heap abuse on you. But they'll have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. They heap abuse on you. They see you refraining and you won't be self-indulgent. You won't go with them. And they think, what an idiot. What's wrong with you? What's your problem? They would praise an athlete if they did that. But Peter here is telling these Christians, he's going to tell them, you've had your time of self-indulgence. You've had your time in your life to be without self-control and to enjoy all the good things, the partying of this life and the lack of self-restraint. It's time to change. It's time to change that. So he starts this saying it, and he says, you got to follow Christ. You got to buckle down and you got to be like the Lord. Look in verse 1. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves with the same attitude. It's an attitude thing first. It's an attitude. Because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he doesn't live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you've spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery. It's another big word, but it just means wastefulness. Lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, detestable idolatry. They think it's strange that you don't plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. But they'll have to give an account to him who's ready to judge the quick and the dead. So he says, you did that. You had your fun. But it's time to change. You got to buckle down and be self. It's interesting. He doesn't apologize for that. You know, you ever feel like you need to apologize when you tell somebody, you know, they want to be a Christian. They want to start serving the Lord. But you know they're practicing things they can't practice. And you just don't want to tell them that, because you know it may just shut the door. You tell them they have to stop it. You know, you can't be a Christian and do this. It may just shut the door and that'll be it, and they'll just go away and they'll never come back. Well, Peter doesn't seem to worry about that. You have to make a choice. I mean, athletes in the world, if they want to be athletes and good, strong athletes and win races, they know they got to be self-disciplined and stop it. So why should we not tell somebody else, if you want to be a Christian, this is what you got to do. Sorry. I mean, you can say it with love, but, you know, you got to tell people. You can't just keep on doing that and expect to go to heaven. Success requires discipline. It does in the world, and it does if you want to be a Christian. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, in the last part of that last verse, he said, I beat my body. It means he prayed. Beats it into subjection. And he says, I make it my slave. I make it my slave. Does your body serve you, or do you serve your appetites in your body? That's the question. I make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the cross. Okay, last one. Last one. Success procures a crown. This is the last lesson. Looking at verse 24. Four, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone that competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. So the first one is they do it, which would be the world, to get a perishable wreath. That's what most translations has. New American Standard has it. And by the King James, we're a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Think about that for just a minute. Because it was a comparison. Beforehand, Paul's been comparing the Christian to the athlete. He's kind of showing the parallel. Now he switches and he makes a contrast between the Christian and the athlete. There's a lot of people working very hard to win perishable crowns. Lots of people trying to win these. Here's a guy. Anybody recognize this guy? Probably wouldn't do it, not if you're too young. This is Mark McGuire. He worked really hard to get a crown. He's Mark McGuire. Now, he's retired. He retired back in 2001, so he's been out of this for a while. He worked really hard to get a crown. And he did. He beat this fellow out. His name was Roger Maris. I definitely don't know him. The only reason I know him is because I know Mark McGuire. Otherwise, I'd never heard of Roger Maris. But he beat him. He got the most home runs in a single season, 61. That's what Roger had. Now, Mark passed him up. I think he actually got 70 that year. But he beat him. And he won a prize. He broke his record. But like I said, the only reason I know Roger Maris is because Mark McGuire. Otherwise, I'd never known the guy. You know, in probably 50 years, the only reason people will know Mark McGuire is because somebody breaks his record. If they haven't already, I may just not be it. Somebody already has it. Get that. Anyway, you don't know these guys very long because somebody's going to break their record, and the other guys just kind of drift off into the past. They're gone. You don't even think about them anymore. But they work for a crown. Here's what they were. Here's what the guys back in Corinth were working for. That was their crown. It was a wreath made out of pine needles. And they've upgraded that just a little bit now. You get a wreath or you get a ring. That's a gold ring. But either way, they're temporal prizes. They don't last very long. And there are other crowns that people like too, that some of these guys work for the crown of money and other people work for the crown of fame. You make a lot of money. You win these. That's a great prize. A lot of people make a lot of money at these. And some people just really care about the fame. Everybody knows me. They know me nationally. They know me internationally. And so they work for that, because that's very, very prestigious to have your name on some plaque somewhere or in a dictionary somewhere. But can you tell me the name of just one fellow that won the games, the Isthmian Games? Anybody know anybody? Probably not. I don't know anybody. No, there's probably a name. I found one on Wiki, but I didn't write it down because I didn't. So it's hard to remember people after a while. They just don't. It's very temporal. But they procured a crown. Their success procured a crown. It was just perishable. It just didn't last very long. But we work for something different. Success, spiritual success, competing in the race of life. and running without quitting and running to the end with all of our heart procures a different kind of crown, an eternal crown. Paul said that, 1 Corinthians 9, that we win a prize. Now, can you name a... he said, they do it to receive perishable, but we an imperishable. Can you name a winner in the game of life? Probably so. Probably maybe Barnabas or any of those, the people in the New Testament. Many of the people in the New Testament we'll think of, like Paul or maybe Mary, the mother of Jesus, or Martha, or Lazarus. I mean, you can name those people. Because we know they and you can even go back even further than that. You can go back to the Old Testament and you remember Job, or you might remember Abraham, you might David. These people lived thousands of years ago, 2,000, 4,000 years ago, but we know their names. They managed to stay. You know why? Because their name's in a different kind of book. Their names are in the book of life. God wrote them down. Those count. Those are the prizes that really count because they stay. They don't disappear. And, you know, these people sacrifice themselves too. Even to death. Even unto death, they sacrifice themselves. Just like people today will sacrifice themselves in order to win perishable crowns, but we sacrifice ourselves unto death to receive a crown of life. Something that goes beyond this life. That's far more superior, if you ask me. And we don't lose heart. Though our outer man is decaying, our inner man is being renewed day by day. You know, there are a lot of those athletes, if you think about some of them, if I said the word Joe, the name Joe, you could probably put a last name behind that, where some people really broke down. They really decayed during the midst of their professional life. I remember Joe Namath. Bad knees. Just wore him out. Broken down man. And I remember Joe Theismann. We were watching a movie the other night and had a little clip. Just remember that last day when Lawrence Taylor plastered him, broke his leg. That was it. He was out. You know. And what else do you... There's nothing more for your career. You're done. That's the end of football. But a Christian, he decays too. He sacrifices his body. He suffers too as he gives his life and his body to the service of the Lord. But he's always being renewed day by day because this is just the beginning. It's just the entrance into something that's eternal. What a difference. What a different kind of prize to work for. What a different end to work for. And Paul said, Peter said, when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. I don't have a picture of the crown that we get at the end. Don't have one of those. Because it's not. We don't get it till then. It's then. It's there. It's not now. And Paul said too, he said, I fought the good fight. I finished the course. I've kept the faith. And in the future, there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness. That's why you can't see the crown. It's not some kind of temporal thing that you hold. It's the reward of God saying that you are right. You're right with me. I'm going to give you the crown of being able to say, you have served me well. Come and be with me. Well, that's really the end. I had one last point that I thought was kind of neat, worth thinking about. If you look to Revelation chapter 4, one of John's visions, it was a book that was to be encouraging to Christians who had truly run the race, and they had been faithful to the end, unto death. And these people did die. And you get this beautiful picture in Revelation chapter 4. He sees a throne in heaven. And somebody's sitting on it, and it's the Lord. And verse 2 says, at once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with somebody sitting on it. And the one who was there had the appearance of a jasper and a carnelian, and the rainbow resembling an emerald surrounded the throne. You have this beautiful picture of this incredible throne and the Lord sitting on it. And then around that throne, you have a picture of the faithful, people that have been faithful to the Lord. And it says in verse 5, surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders, and they were dressed in white, had crowns of gold on their heads. And so here are the people who've run the race, and they've been successful. They've won the race. And they're sitting on thrones. They're victors. They are reigning. They have crowns. They have procured the crown. They are around the throne. It's a great picture. But there's something that strange happens at the end of this chapter that you need to see, and that's in verse 10 and 11. It goes, as things revolve around the throne, and you see the whole world and everything, you know, praising this the God that's sitting on this throne. Then it says in verse 10, it says, they called out in a loud voice, chapter 4 and verse 10. It says, the 24 elders fall down before Him who sits on the throne and worship Him who lives forever and ever. And they lay their crowns down, or they cast their crowns down before the throne. And they said, You're worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For You created all things, and by Your will they were created and have their being. So they, interesting here, these people who won the crown, and they procure the crown, they won the victory, but they throw their crowns down before the throne. And I think that's a neat thought. I mean, most of our songs that we sing, if you think about it, in our books, are about what we get, aren't they? We're going to get heaven, we're going to go there, we're going to get a crown, we're going to get a mansion, we're going to live in this beautiful place. And that's all well and fine. We do acquire a prize. But, you know, when we get there, I wonder if that will mean as much to us as just being in the presence of God. Of course, there's the illustration of the athlete who's won the Heisman Trophy. You probably remember that. Forget the guy's name. But he appears with his coach next to him, and he gives the trophy to the coach, and he says, you know, this is not my honor. This is the man who deserves the trophy, because he made me who I am. If it wasn't for him, I would never be here. And I wonder if that's not going to be enough for us. You know, when we get there, will we really just be... Are we dreaming of some kind of material object put on our heads? I hope not. I hope not. But I wonder if it won't be just enough for us just to be in the presence of God, the one who's made it possible. There is a song that communicates that idea. It's not in our songbooks. It was in an old songbook. It says, when all my labors and trials are o'er, and there I stand on that beautiful shore, just to be near the dear one I adore, will through the ages be glory for me. It's a good song. I wish we had it. If that was John Kilgore, I'd probably lead it and everybody somehow sing with him, but I don't know it. But it's a good song, and it really does communicate a good point. But that really is what it ought to be, glory enough for us. It's just to be in the presence of the Lord who's done all, who's made it possible. So, the admonition from Paul is to take up our place in the race. Maybe this morning you've never even started the race. Maybe you're kind of sitting at the gate. Maybe you're watching other people run the race, but you haven't joined the race. Maybe you haven't joined the race of life. Maybe you're too, I don't know, consumed with the temporal crowns. Maybe you're busy with things that's been your goals that are just limited. You need to get in the race. And we need to follow Jesus. Like I said, Hebrews 11 paints a picture of all the people who got into the race. And they won the race. They arrived at the end. And they're all encouraging us to participate too and to not give up. And Jesus is at the head. And he says, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of God. He won the race because he ran and he didn't quit. And he stayed faithful to the end. Won't you join that race today? Become a Christian. Turn to Jesus and begin to follow Him, believe in Him, repent of your sins, be baptized to join the race, makes you one of His people, and gives you grace and mercy in abundance, and calls us to run the race to the end. Maybe this evening or morning you'd like to join that race. Do that if you would by coming forward while we stand and sing our song.